This winter, join the Washington Post in its fight against hunger, homelessness, and poverty with a contribution to Post Helping Hand. To learn more and donate, visit posthelpinghand.com.
From the newsroom of the Washington Post.
Hey, it's Ross Helderman from the Post calling. How are you?
Hey there, it's Sungmin from the Post.
It's Dave Ferentz from the Post. Have you got a second Post?
This is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Tuesday, December 31st. Today, how Black women authors have claimed their seat at the publishing table, and remembering one of the pioneers who helped pave their way. This week, we're revisiting some of our favorite stories from the past year. And today, we're focusing on Black women writers, past and present.
I have smiled and nodded while well-meaning magazine editors advised me to tone down my allegories and my anger. I didn't.
N.K. Jemisin is an author.
I have gritted my teeth while an established professional writer went on a 10-minute tirade at me, basically as a proxy for all Black people, for mentioning underrepresentation in the sciences.
In 2018, Jemisin spoke at the Hugo Awards ceremony.
I've kept writing even though my first novel, The Killing Moon, was initially rejected on the assumption that only Black people would ever possibly want to read the work of a Black writer.
Jemisin is the first Black woman ever to win the Hugo Award for science fiction writing. In 2018, she was actually winning for the third time for the final installment in her Broken Earth trilogy.
I have raised my voice to talk back over fellow panelists who tried to talk over me about my own damn life. I have fought myself and the little voice inside me that constantly, still, whispers that I should just keep my head down and shut up and let the real writers talk.
Jemisin is one of the few Black female writers who's had enormous success in a literary genre dominated by white men.
I was very good at writing straight white male characters, even though I am not myself a straight white guy, because I'd read almost nothing but that. Even like words used to describe skin color were not a thing that I'd have a lot of exposure to.
But Jemisin realized that she wanted to change that.
The thing that I wanted to do that I wasn't seeing in a lot of my own fiction, though, was just simply showing people like me as actually having a future, because that was a thing that science fiction and fantasy generally was not doing. You know, I would read these stories set, 5,000 years in the future, whatever, and everybody was white or everybody sounded like they were from Iowa or whatever. And, you know, it just made you wonder what the hell happened.
The Broken Earth trilogy is a fantasy set on a future Earth suffering through a climate catastrophe. Her main protagonist is a middle-aged woman of color. And seeing a character like that in the center of this big, otherworldly narrative feels revolutionary, not just in sci-fi, but also in other genres.
My name is Lauren Wilkinson. I am the author of American Spy.
Wilkinson's debut novel came out this year. The American spy in the title is a Black woman, Marie Mitchell, who becomes an intelligence officer in the 1980s.
I read a lot of Le Carre, a spy who came in from the cold. The Bond books for sure were very prominent, so they looked very, very white and male.
Which didn't make sense to Wilkinson, because the whole point of being a spy is having the ability to blend in and to code switch when necessary.
Okay, so let's say that you are like a CIA officer. You are undercover, probably. If you walk into a room and everyone's like, oh, that's James Bond, or oh, that's that spy, then who's going to tell you any secrets? You'd be terrible at your job.
Well, also because so much of, especially how you describe being a spy, is basically a form of passing, right? That you are in a situation where you are trying to blend in among people, but always extremely concerned that you're going to be kind of found out. And that's
potentially dangerous if you're found out. I mean, and that's for me the parallel for racial passing in the 20th century, early 20th century in this country, how dangerous it was.
But sci-fi and spy novels are not the only genres that have been historically dominated by white writers.
My name is Jasmine Guillory, and I'm a romance writer. It feels like it's been a it's been a really hard few years to be a Black woman in America. And I want to put more joy out there in the world for us. You know, I know a lot of Black women who have gotten their happy endings. I know a lot of Black women who have fell in love, who have, you know, had like wonderful love stories. I want to tell those stories to the world.
And so she did in her debut novel, The Wedding Date.
Alexa Monroe is the chief of staff to the mayor of Berkeley. She is sort of a short, plus-size Black woman. And one of the reasons that she's very surprised that this man asks her to be his date to the wedding is that he is, you know, a tall, attractive white doctor from Los Angeles.
Why was it important for you to have a Black woman represented in The Wedding Date as the core character?
If I was going to do this, like, I wanted to write a book about someone who reflected the things that I knew, someone who reflected, like, the world and the good and the bad things that I have lived through and the people I know who have lived through. And it just felt important to me to write a character like Alexa.
I mean, for me, this is a spy book, but it's secretly just an opportunity to talk about a Black woman's feelings for 300 pages, you know? So I assume that it's women who maybe this book will resonate most with, particularly if they've ever tried to navigate, you know, the professional lives and the kind of being told directly and indirectly that they're reaching beyond where they're supposed to. I feel that a lot of women can identify with that, and particularly women of color. I don't think that I'm trying to represent anyone in particular, but I think that if Black women read it and didn't like it, that would be the group that I would be most upset that I let down.
But what I think is so important about what you're doing is that it has this sense of familiarity with, like, with structural oppression and with the ways in which the themes of being an other now in the world today are also applicable in the future.
In a lot of science fiction stories, you know, the way that they choose to engage with it is by having aliens be oppressed or robots be oppressed or something like that. And meanwhile, the humans in the story are still all white people from Iowa. So, you know, what it comes down to is that the writers of these sort of strange looking oppression stories want to engage with the subject matter, but they're still uncomfortable themselves around actual living people of color or actual living people from diverse backgrounds that are not theirs. So in a lot of cases, they are trying to tackle a subject in allegory that they're not comfortable dealing with in reality. They're not willing to actually engage with it on the level that it kind of needs to be. And they're not willing to engage with the people who are most affected by it. And so, you know, kind of making the robots be oppressed or the aliens be oppressed is sort of a cop-out in a lot of cases.
For Jasmine Guillory, what makes her novels feel fresh and relevant is somewhat of the opposite. The fact that, at least when it comes to romance, structural oppression doesn't have to be front and center in the love lives of Black women.
Well, what I think is really interesting about The Wedding Date in particular is the fact that it depicts an interracial relationship, but it doesn't do it in a way that makes that the core of the narrative. And I just think it's really cool the way that your book talks about the fact that this is an interracial romance and addresses it and doesn't completely gloss over it, but it's not like a core conflict.
Right. I mean, I think that was something that was really important to me while writing it, is that I didn't want, you know, I wanted race to be talked about in the book because race is something that I think normal people of color talk about in their daily lives all the time, but not in a like constant oppressive way, right? It is something that, you know, something comes up, you mention it and then briefly talk about it and move on and talk about other things. And that's how I wanted the conversations about race to be in this book. And I absolutely didn't want like their core conflict to be about, you know, oh no, I am Black and you are white. What are we going to do? Like, I don't think that is, I mean, I know a lot of people who have been in interracial relationships and have been myself. That is never the core conflict.
What's notable is that Guillory, Jemison, and Wilkinson have all found success in a publishing industry that gets a lot of criticism for its lack of diversity, both in the authors that they publish and also in their own staff.
Publishing is still a business that is owned by white men, and, you know, the people at the top are all white men.
In a 2018 survey of the top romance publishers, only 7.7% of books were written by people of color. Another recent survey of the publishing industry found that 82% of the editorial staff was white.
For the longest time throughout my childhood, there were really only like four writers of color: Chip Delaney, Octavia Butler, Nalo Hopkinson, and Stephen Barnes. But, you know, everyone would sort of bring out those four names whenever you wanted to try and point out that, you know, there's a little bit of a gap here between what the readership or what, you know, society looks like and what the writership looks like. And so, you know, when you've got such a small number of people and when you've got gatekeepers within the genre actually actively working to try and keep those tiny group of people from growing, or even trying to keep them from expressing themselves clearly, that's a big part of the problem.
I think publishing has always had this idea that, like, Black people don't read books and that Black people don't buy books and that therefore, what's the point of putting out books that are geared towards them, right? But I think Black people have always known that we read a lot of books and we also buy a lot of books.
That's why, for a long time, the way that many writers of color were able to make a name for themselves was by self-publishing. And this was especially true for romance writers.
Romance has always been diverse. I think it's only that recently big publishing has started to catch up with that, right? And so it's been really wonderful to see at least a little bit that big publishing is starting to catch up to how diverse romance can be.
That there is an audience for it now is exciting for me. You know, that people are like, oh, I do want to explore a new world in the movies that I watch and the books that I read. Yeah, that is one of the best things about writing right now in 2019.
Do you feel like there still is a resistance to widening representation among publishers, among gatekeepers in publishing?
I think we need to just kind of always remember that this is about sales and this is about a product, right? And, you know, and for me, it is art. I took a very long, maybe 7 years writing this book. So it means a lot to me. But I always knew that it was going to be an object that was going to be placed, positioned somewhere in a market. And I think that there is right now people look at products created by people of color and they say, I think we can sell this now, you know, and I think we can sell it. And that is a complicated thing. That's a complicated way to feel because, you know, when you're like, oh, well, this person thinks they can sell it now because of a trend, you know, what happens when you're no longer on trend? That's a scary thing when your identity feels like it's a part of a trend. But I think that those things are built into like our economic system.
Do you feel like there has been a moment to celebrate that or that it is still a struggle against the tide?
You know, we've made the start of progress. Yay, Black Panther, but that's one movie. You know, we've got several decades of film history that we're going to have to work against before we start to approach anywhere near parity, let alone actual equity. So, no, I don't believe we've reached a point where we can celebrate. I think we've reached a point where there are actually enough of us to have a conversation without getting drowned out. That's a long way from celebration. There's a lot of discussion of the fact that, you know, there's a big difference between diversity and decolonization. And diversity is a great thing. It's just that it's sort of superficial. You get enough people in the room who look, you know, sound like they're all from different backgrounds and so forth. But if the people who are taking up all the air in that room are still the same old folks, And if the conversation is still centered on those folks, if all of the heroes look like those folks and so forth, then it doesn't matter what kind of diversity you've got in the room because it's not real practical diversity. So the way to kind of address the issue is not just to look at physically who is in the room, but also to try and make sure that you're not following the same patterns and not replicating the same power structures that have caused the problem in the first place.
N.K. Jemisin is the author of several novels, including the Broken Earth trilogy. Lauren Wilkinson's debut novel is American Spy. Jasmine Guillory's newest novel is called The Wedding Party. And now, one more thing. You can't talk about Black women writers without talking about Toni Morrison. She died in August at the age of 88. Here's how we remembered her then. When I was in eighth grade, I discovered a book on my mom's shelf. It was called Sula. And when I read it, it completely changed the way I thought about myself and my place in the world. It was about loneliness and connection and women coming into their own and discovering the power of their own minds. And it was about being Black. Toni Morrison was the author of that book, and many others. The Bluest Eye, Beloved, Song of Solomon.
So in the opening essay in The Source of Self-Regard, it's called Peril, and it was about the dangers of censorship and the dangers of when artists are silenced. And she writes that, quote, "Certain kinds of trauma visited on peoples are so deep, so cruel, that unlike money, unlike vengeance, even unlike justice or fights, or the goodwill of others, only writers can translate such trauma and turn sorrow into meaning, sharpening the moral imagination. A writer's life and work are not a gift to mankind, they are its necessity." I'm Bilal Qureshi. I'm a writer and occasional contributor to the Washington Post's Book World. Well, I think Toni Morrison has been a mythical figure in American literature for a long time. I mean, she won the Nobel Prize in Literature and was the first African-American woman to do so. Her novels grappled with the entire range of history of the Black experience in this country, but beyond that, about women, about love, about family, about home. So she took this sort of very specific experience of America that she had and found a way to write in a way that spoke to global audiences and earned her the highest award in literature.
Generally speaking, women's work has been reduced to regional or merely, or people compliment ethnic writers by saying or implying that they are as good as mainstream writers. And whereas I understood the compliment, I thought it would be better for me, at least in the late 60s and early 70s, to establish once and for all that all three of those things play. I'm Black, I am a woman, and I'm a writer, and they go together.
Toni Morrison gave her Nobel lecture in December 1993.
We die. That may be the meaning of life. But we do language. That may be the measure of our lives.
Toni Morrison also always talked about how important it is to sort of be very critical about the language that we read. The language that we read in the media, the language that we hear in our societies, the words that people use, to be very awake to them.
The systematic looting of language can be recognized by the tendency of its users to forego its nuanced, complex, midwifery properties for menace and subjugation. Oppressive language does more than represent violence. It is violence. Does more than represent the limits of knowledge. It limits knowledge. Sexist language, racist language, theistic language, all are typical of the policing languages of mastery and do not permit new knowledge or encourage the mutual exchange of ideas.
I think in reading her again and sort of having come back to her work in this decade of my life, I'm just reminded that, yeah, she has something to say to all of us. And, you know, I'm not a Black woman, but I certainly feel that her art allows you to inhabit that subjectivity, to see what that experience of the world is like. And that's the extraordinary power of her work. And that's why I think so many people are paying tribute to her, because her work transcended any narrow categories that it may have been placed in. So many of the things that she has been grappling with in her work, her entire career, are the exact same questions that we're talking about right now. American identity, racism, representation, white supremacy, gender, politics, self-regard. And I think that idea really has stayed with me, that in the face of sort of dehumanization, degradation, a culture that doesn't see you, that renders you invisible, that commits violence against who you are as a person, as an individual, as a citizen, what does it mean to have self-regard? What does it mean to have the confidence and the pride and the power to make art and to express your view of the world? So that, for me, feels so urgent to any of us who are living in America today, especially those of us who are maybe people of color or people who have immigrant backgrounds. You are constantly surrounded by this language of who belongs and who doesn't. And I think Toni Morrison offers a lot of answers to a lot of those questions.
Bilal Qureshi is a contributor to The Washington Post.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow is New Year's Day. From all of us at Post Reports, we wish you, our listeners, a very happy New Year. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back on Thursday with more stories from The Washington Post.
Contributions to Post Helping Hand go directly to services run by beneficiaries Bright Beginnings and Street Village and So Others Might Eat that provide shelter, food, education, and other services to those less fortunate in the Washington, D.C. region. Learn more at posthelpinghand.com.